Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
We've talked about him before, but Benny Friedman is by many considered to be the first modern NFL quarterback. He sort of set the stage. But we're going to talk more about Benny Friedman, his accomplishments in the NFL, and what he did for the New York Giants with historian Larry Schmidt. He's going to talk to us in just a moment about Benny Friedman and the Giants.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And welcome to another session of great football history. We have our friend Larry Schmidt here to join us in our Giants 100th anniversary tour that we have going on here. Larry, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, thanks for having me, Darren. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, Larry, you have really set me on a course of learning a lot about the Giants. It was your idea, really, that when we were talking via email a few months ago, we were talking something about the Giants. I forget exactly what we were talking about. And you said, you know, this is the Giants 100th season coming up in 2024. And you really put me on a path of education here, and I appreciate that.
Well, it's my pleasure. I love football history, and the Giants are my team, and, you know, you can only have one 100th anniversary, so it's now or never.
That's for sure. Yeah, I don't think I'll be around for the 200, so I got to get it in now.
Me either.
It's like the recent eclipse they had. They said that the next full eclipse we'll have in my area would be 2099, so I'd be like 133 years old, so I'm holding out hope for that one. So Larry, what you've got some great stuff to talk about, some Giants history today. And I'd love to hear some more about this because, like I said, you're really giving us education here.
Yeah, well, we were going to talk about the first legendary passer of the NFL, Benny Friedman. You know, the gentleman who really brought the forward pass into pro football as a strategic weapon, you know, through the from 1920 up until he joined the league, passing was just a desperation measure. Teams would, you know, run it on first down, run it on second down. And quite honestly, a lot of teams would punt rather than attempt a forward pass. But he was very confident in his ability, and he was an outstanding passer, especially, you know, when he started playing, the NFL was still using that big fat pumpkin ball. It was almost like a rugby ball. He would throw the ball on first down. He would throw the ball on second down. And when you, unfortunately, statistics were not officially recorded in the NFL until 1932, which was at the very end of his career. But when you read game summaries, when you go back in the newspapers and you read the accounts of the games, many of them point out the fact that, you know, one of them called him the audacious Benny Friedman. You know, he was throwing the ball on first down. He was throwing the ball like deep in his own territory. The Giants would have the ball on like their own 5-yard line, and he would come out swinging it. And, you know, commonly accepted strategy at that time, if, you know, someone punts you the ball and you're stuck inside your 10, some teams wouldn't even run a play. They would just punt it back and play defense and try to, you know, win the field position battle just by exchanging punts back and forth. So he was very, very different, and he was really the first great passer until Sammy Ball came along later on.
Yeah, I mean, I got to see a little bit about Benny Friedman, and like you said, he was quite innovative and quite the weapon, and very coveted by the Giants, too. Maybe you could tell a little bit about that backstory on how that he was acquired by the Giants.
Right. So when he came out of college, he played for the Michigan Wolverines, and he was a legend. He was the second biggest name in college football after Red Grange. And in fact, he and Red Grange played against one another. They were both in the Big Ten. Red Grange played at Illinois, and they had a legendary meeting. You know, Red Grange came out of college a year prior to Friedman. But Friedman's first team was the Cleveland Bulldogs in 1927, and he led the NFL with 9 touchdown passes that year, right out of the gate. And for his 2 years, you know, Cleveland only lasted 1 year. It's a little fuzzy whether the franchise either relocated or they closed up shop, and then many of the leftover players then signed with a new team in Detroit, of the Detroit Wolverines. Not coincidentally, they named the team the Wolverines, trying to capitalize on Friedman's popularity. But for those 2 years, 1927 and 1928, Friedman combined for 20 touchdown passes. The second most touchdown passes over that 2 year span was Ken Mercer from the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets with 9. And not only did Friedman have more than twice as many, when you look at the games played, Frankfurt, they used to, many times they would play 2 games on a weekend because they weren't allowed to play football on Sundays because of blue laws in Philadelphia. So they would play home games on Saturday, and then they would travel and play on Sunday. So they, over those 2 years, the Yellow Jackets played 34 games, and Friedman's two teams, Cleveland and Detroit, only played 23. So Friedman was averaging almost a touchdown pass a game, 20 touchdown passes over 23 games, which was unheard of. Unheard of. Nobody came close to that. And it's unfortunate, you know, there's no record of attempts, completions, yards. You can't calculate a passing percentage. You don't know what his yards per attempt was. Interceptions weren't even an official stat. You know, if you read through a game summary, you know, they'll mention an interception or two, but you don't really know. You don't know if they caught them all. You don't know if he threw two or three. You just have to kind of surmise. But you do know the who threw a touchdown pass because that was always in the box score. So in 2 years, 20 touchdowns in 23 games. The second ranked guy, 9 touchdowns in 34 games.
That is amazing. It definitely, you could see he was had started a trend, had something going. People are seeing his productivity and the points that his teams are putting up. So, yeah, I guess
Yeah, he was a little too far ahead of his time. The trend took some time. It wasn't really until a couple of years after he retired with Sammy Baugh when the forward pass really started to become a part of the pro game. And you know, and it's funny when you read the game summaries in the editorials, or even sometimes within the game summary itself, the writer would talk about playing straight football, which is a code term for just running the ball. A lot of people at the time still thought of the forward pass as a gimmick, and it's not real football. You know, real football is you slam it up to the line, and it's a game of brute force and strictly blocking and tackling, you know, at the line of scrimmage. And, you know, throwing the forward pass was considered, to some people, it was actually like disreputable. It wasn't like real football.
Well, at that point, they had almost 50 years of seeing that, just that, pound the line. And the forward pass came officially 1906, but nobody was really using it till
No.
1912.
Well, they had the rule you had to be 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage to throw a forward pass. I know for a while, an incomplete pass would be loss of possession. Throwing an incomplete pass into the end zone was actually a safety. It was 2 points, and the other, you know, I had to free kick it to the other team. It took a while for the penalties for that to be lessened, and the pros actually really, you know, embraced it in 1933, which was Friedman's, you know, next to last year. He was a player coach, and he retired after 34.
Isn't that kind of interesting? And not to change the subject, but usually it's the college game back in that era, and early football would sort of be the trendsetter. The NFL would copy them. In this case, the forward pass was more widely accepted in the pro game, sort of their gimmick, and the college caught on a few years later.
That's right. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've been doing some research for an article, and I found this great, it's like a 2.5 page, almost 3 page story. And the gentleman who wrote it, he actually, this was in 1920, 1925, 1926, maybe 27. He actually said the NFL should come up with their own rule book to differentiate themselves from the colleges. And he used Major League Baseball as an example. He said, you know, Major League Baseball, they set up their own rules, and the minor leagues and the colleges, they all follow the Major League Baseball rule book. Pro football was the opposite. They followed the college rule book up through 1932. And part, and the biggest reason they did that was to differentiate themselves, to make themselves different. And they wanted to higher scoring. They wanted more excitement, not just run, punt. And, you know, so they came up with the rules, you know, legalized the forward pass from the line of scrimmage. They moved the hash marks in. They moved the goalposts up to the goal line to increase scoring and make it a little bit more exciting for the fans.
Maybe not safer, but more exciting.
You know, part of it was safety. You know, we were talking about in the early 1900s, you know, so many players were injured badly and players used to die on the field. And part of the thought process was spread it out, make it a little bit, you know, more of a horizontal game and not have, you know, 22 guys slamming on each other within the line of scrimmage. So that was part of the impetus for that.
Yeah, I was saying it more in reference to the goalpost going up on the goal line instead of
Oh, line. yeah.
So,
Well,
yeah, good
but
point though.
everybody was missing the people were missing extra points and field goals, and they wanted more points on the board. They didn't want every game to be 6-0, you know,
Yeah.
6-0 with a touchdown and a missed point after.
That's for sure. That's for sure.
And they were still drop kicking then too.
Yeah,
Less accurate.
that takes a special skill. I don't know if you've ever tried to drop kick a ball through a goalpost.
I have, but it was with like regulation NFL football. You know, if you have that rugby ball, it's a lot easier.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't. Yeah, it's easier than kicking our footballs,
You have to
but
have a strong
it's
leg though,
still,
because it's bigger and it's
yeah,
heavier.
those things are heavy, man.
Yes, they were.
Yeah, very, very, very cool. Now, so tell us a little bit more. Now, I mean, you have more to tell us on Friedman? Because I have a couple questions.
Because you actually, you know, mentioned that he was a significant player for the Giants. So, you know, he had those 2 great years with Cleveland and Detroit, but the franchises themselves struggled. They didn't draw well, and they were in financial difficulty. And Friedman actually, that year with the Wolverines, he did something that no NFL player did before or has done since. He led the NFL in rushing and passing touchdowns. He ran for 6 touchdowns and he threw for 9. So he led the NFL in touchdowns and scoring. And with his two teams, Cleveland and Detroit, he was undefeated against the Giants. He beat them twice, and the best the Giants could do was they tied them. One, you know, each year they had a win and a tie against the Giants, and that's including the 1927 Giants, who were otherwise undefeated. It was one of the strongest teams of the 1920s. They set a record for shutouts, and they couldn't do anything against Benny Friedman. So Tim Mara, the owner of the Giants, bought the entire Detroit Wolverines franchise just to get Benny Friedman on his team. If we can't beat him, let's sign him.
Yeah, good strategy.
It worked.
Exactly. Now, I think it was kind of interesting though, 'cause about the time they got Friedman, another subject that I've been, doing some research on here lately and posted some stuff recently is on Hinkie Haynes. And Hinkie was sort of like he was catching some passes for touchdowns. And it's interesting they I don't think those two played on the same Giants team, did they?
No, they didn't. Hinkie Haynes retired, I believe, in 28.
And it went up.
Actually, I think his last year with the Giants was 27, and then in 28, I think he played 1 year with the Staten Island Stapletons, and
Correct.
then he retired. But you know, he joined the NFL older as a rookie, you know, because after college he played at Penn State, but then he served in World War I. And then after he came back from the war, he played a few years in the coal mine leagues in Eastern Pennsylvania before the Giants got him. So I don't remember exactly what his age was, but he might have been like 26 years old his first year with the
Yeah, he.
Giants.
You're, I think you're spot on. He was mid-20s or somewhere when he came in, but
Right. But he
he
graduated college in like 1917, but instead of playing football, he had to go serve in the infantry in Europe during World War One.
Well, he finished. He went to Lafayette College, went to World War One, then went to Penn State after World War One.
Oh, okay.
And then went to the Anthracite League for Shenandoah, and playing against the Pottsvilles and Frankfurts, yep. Before they were in the NFL. So very, very cool. But I think that would have been such a cool thing to see. A little. I'm picturing him to be sort of like a little scat back, pain in the ass, real quick.
Yeah, he was every
Dave,
article I
Dave
read
Meggett
always
talked type
about
of
his speed. He was
type
very
guy.
Fast. He wasn't, like they had Jack McBride on the team, and Jack McBride was the between the tackles runner. He was like the fullback. Although it was interesting because he was like the Giants passer, Jack McBride, but he was the bigger player. So he would run, into the line between the tackles, and Hinkie Haynes would do the end arounds and the sweeps, and he was the speed guy.
That would have been interesting to have Friedman and him on the same team and seeing some of the things they could have done with that.
Yeah, he could have been
in the
a
backfield.
Could have been a real, like a 1920s, Tom Brady to Randy Moss. He would have been the downfield threat.
Right. Yeah,
he could have been Don Hutson before Don Hutson. But
exactly. Yeah, that would have been interesting.
Not the right time. Not the right era for him.
Yeah, I guess not. Yeah, you've been sending some fantastic photographs from old newspaper clippings. I assume from like the New York area, most of them, and many of them are of Benny Friedman. And some are from programs and things like that. But
yep.
That we've been sharing, so we appreciate you doing that. But
he was the star guy. He was the gate attraction. When you look at the billing for the, for the ads for football games, it was Benny Friedman's Giants or Benny Friedman and the Giants. Like he got top billing before the team. The only other player I've ever seen that for was Red Grange. It would be Red Grange's Bears, or when he was in the AFL, it was Red Grange's Yankees. Even
right,
sometimes in the league standings, depending on what newspaper you were reading, in the standing it would say Grange's Yankees, like Wilson's Wildcats. I never saw Friedman's Giants in the standings, but in the in the ads for the newspapers, it's come see Benny Friedman's Giants, not the New York Football Giants. Benny Friedman's Giants.
You got to get that marquee name there somewhere in the advertisement. Have the draw come in. That's their hook.
That's
hook
why they
in.
signed him, and that's why they put the number one on his back.
Yeah, that's a tremendous player there. Then I'm glad you were able to tell us a little bit more about him. So yeah, fantastic. So yeah, your research has been impeccable on him and some of these other early players. And like I said, we really appreciate that. And you have a few projects going on that maybe you'd like to share with the listeners so we can see some more of your work.
Yeah. So just recently, I finished up because it's the Giants' 100th anniversary. 10 years ago for the 90th anniversary, I did a very, very extensive, in-depth article on the Giants all-time team. And what I did, it's so hard to compare players like Benny Friedman and Hinkie Haynes against contemporary players because the rules were different. The ball was different. Everything was different. You can't compare a 1920s player to a 2000s player. It's not fair. And it doesn't make sense. You have to grade them against their peers, guys who played with the similar ability in the same era under the same rules, the same conditions, and all that. So we broke it down. We had a single platoon era, and then we had the modern era, the 50s up through, I believe, 1978 with the rules changes. Then we had the postmodern era. So we have, it's basically three teams. And then for this past year, we did an update on it, and Eric Kennedy, who runs Big Blue Interactive, he's a huge help. And he collaborates with me on some of the projects like this. So we just posted that a couple of weeks ago. And I'm working my deep dive project for the off season is the, we're going to title it the 1926 Giants because it's for Big Blue Interactive, but it's a little bit more comprehensive. It's going to be the rivalry with CC Pyle and Red Grange's league, the first American Football League, and just all the problems, all the drama and all the problems that caused, and how it nearly almost like it nearly bankrupt the Giants. And it was just devastating to the NFL and pro football in general. It hurt football's reputation because, we're talking about how the colleges are more popular and, the pros and their pants and their fancy pantsing, and it's not straight football. And it was just, it's just so interesting. And it's just something that's kind of become forgotten about, and there's just a lot that I can just dig up in the archives, and I just And it's funny because I go in there looking to find one thing, and then like I was telling you about that article that I found. Like I had no idea that existed, and it's like, wow, this is just tremendous. So you never know what you're going to find. It's always interesting, and it's going to take me a little while before it's ready. It's a lot of work, but you know, I love doing it and I love sharing it.
Yeah, well, we appreciate the sharing that you do and your work that you do on Big Blue Interactive, the stuff in the GUD, and also the items that you share with us and help us out with. We really appreciate all that.
Yeah. Hey, the uniforms back then were great too. But I'm looking at your background there. The teams back in the 1920s sure loved their stripes.
Yeah.
That's something that's missing from today's striped socks. Where did they go? Striped sleeves. We missed that.
Behind me is an 1897 game. This is the
Yeah.
famous game of Lafayette and Penn. Penn was undefeated for a couple seasons in a row, and Lafayette was coached by Park H. Davis, the historian. And Park H. Davis pulled in a ringer for one game, a guy named Fielding Yost, who went on to be a coach at
Oh,
Michigan.
a
And
familiar name, yes.
Lafayette ended up winning that game and breaking Penn's streak, and the Quakers are still upset about it. I still see people quipping about that,
Oh, they look great in
130
those
years
striped
ago.
uniforms, I could say
Yeah, pretty
that.
cool. We'll be right back to talk more about Benny Friedman and the New York Giants right after this message. Now we return to our conversation with Larry Schmidt on Benny Friedman and the early New York Giants.
Yeah, well, we left off with Tim Mara bought the whole Detroit team. So 1929, Friedman's first year with the Giants, they made him like the marquee guy. He was on the cover of every game program. They gave him the number one. And that year, he set an NFL record that would last into the 1940s with 20 touchdown passes. So in one season, he matched his mark for the previous two. That record lasted until 1942 when Cecil Isbell of the Packers passed it with 24. That year in the NFL, they were across the whole league, there were 79 touchdown passes. The second ranked team was 12, which was Green Bay, which was split between Red Dunn and Vern Llewellyn. And the Giants, with all that passing and all those passing touchdowns, they by far, they scored more than twice as many points as the rest of the NFL. They averaged almost 21 points a game. It was 20.8. The league average was under 10. The NFL averaged 9.6 yards per game. And I can't say this is an absolute fact, but the first three touchdown passing game that I've ever found, it was Benny Friedman on October 20th of 1929 against Frankfurt. He threw three touchdown passes. I can say with certainty that it was the first three touchdown passing game for the Giants. And the amazing thing is, you know, they were blowing out Frankfurt in that game. He only played the first half. So he threw three touchdowns in two quarters and then he sat on the bench for the whole second half of the game. But less than a month later, he did become the first quarterback to throw four touchdown passes in a game, which he did against the Bears on November 17th. And there was a nice quote at the beginning of the game summary from the New York Times where they called Benny Friedman the passing wizard who completed passes all over the lot. So that was one of the first times I've ever seen a sports writer championing throwing the football and saying it was great to watch and it was entertaining, you know, rather than, well, you know, the Giants didn't play straight football. They resorted to gimmickry and shenanigans, which you would see sometimes, you know, not everybody liked it. It was a little controversial, you know. How dare they throw the football? And then,
I think you might be onto something there because I have never heard of anybody in that era throwing three touchdown passes before Friedman. So I think you might be
yeah,
right, especially with
and
the way
you
he
know,
was
if
setting
I
trends.
go through every box score from 1920 through 1929, I could figure it out. Give me a weekend to work on that. It's definitely the first one in Giants history. It may have been in the NFL, but I'm not sure. I can't say that as a fact. But he was the first to throw four. That's a fact. So that year, the Giants had a tremendous year. The only team they couldn't beat was the Packers, and the Packers won the NFL championship that year. The next year, again, it was the Giants and the Packers. The Giants, by far, they led the league in scoring. There were only Friedman threw 13 touchdown passes that year, a little fewer than the year before. But there were only 77 touchdown passes across the entire NFL. And again, Green Bay was second. They used to be, the Packers were the other team that used to throw the ball a little bit more. But they did that with three passers. It was Dunn, Llewellyn, and also Arnie Herber. You know, they combined, they were platooning with the guys throwing. And then that year again, unfortunately, also against Frankfurt, Friedman became the first NFL player to throw five touchdown passes in a game. And that did not happen again until 1937. And in that game, it's unofficial because it's 1930. Stats weren't official until 1932. But Benny Friedman has what is believed to be the first known 300-yard passing game, where he threw for 310 yards. Now, you know, because Friedman was such a well-known marquee player, you know, he would get the billing, Friedman's Giants. Sometimes a sports writer would take it upon himself to chart stats for a marquee player. The only other two players I've seen that happen for would be Red Grange and Ernie Nevers. You know, sometimes they would, okay, Ernie Nevers carried the ball this many times, scored a couple of touchdowns, this many yards. And of course, you know, he would also drop kick. So Benny Friedman was that level of a guy with Grange and Ernie Nevers, where sometimes if a sports writer felt like it, he would chart the stats for that game. So he did that for Friedman that day, and it's not official, but it is some, you know, something to recognize. And the first official 300-yard passing game in NFL history was actually, I didn't write it down in my notes. I believe it was in the 1940s, though. I'll have to send that to you in an email. I apologize.
Yeah, send that to me, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Sure.
And the accompanying poster. So, yeah. Wow, great stuff.
That's right. Cool. And, you know, when Friedman's gate attraction prowess, the Giants averaged 16,000 fans for their home games in 1928. Just by putting Benny Friedman on the team, their attendance jumped up to over 21,000 in 1929. They averaged 21,250 approximately.
Wow.
So then after 1930, Friedman suffered a knee injury late in the year, and that's actually what cost the Giants the title that year. He missed a game and a half. The Giants lost both those games because they couldn't score without him. Green Bay ended up beating them out on percentage points, on winning percentage. So he started 1931 coaching at Yale, but the Giants were having a tough year. And they actually, Tim Mara actually talked him into coming back and playing, where they had this deal where the Giants used to practice in the morning. So he would come to the morning, practice with the Giants, and then he would take the train to New Haven, and then he would coach Yale in the afternoon. So he only played 9 games that year. He started 5, but the Giants just, you know, they needed him on the team. They were struggling on the field. And of course, when he left, the attendance dipped a little bit. After the season, Friedman asked Tim Mara, he wanted to be the coach, but he also wanted a percentage of the ownership of the Giants. And, you know, Mara wouldn't sell. He said, you know, the Giants are my team. They're staying in the family. So Friedman left, and he finished up his career in Brooklyn with the Dodgers from 1932 through 1934. 1932 was his last full year as a player. He played every game, and he played pretty well. But then in 33, he played like half the games. And then in 1934, he was pretty much just a coach. I think he only played in one game that season. But for Friedman's first 4 years in the league, every team he played on, Cleveland, Detroit, and his first 2 years with the Giants, all those teams led the NFL in scoring, and he was an all-pro in all 4 of those years. And, you know, in addition to being a great passer, he was a triple threat. He was a runner, and he was also a very good kicker. You know, over his career, he kicked 71 point after touchdowns and a couple of field goals. And, you know, the one thing that hurt him, you know, he didn't make the Hall of Fame until 2005, and a big part of it was the fact that statistics just weren't kept. You know, there was one, again, you know, reading in these articles, there was someone after his career ended, went through like every game summary and read all these box scores, and he came up with a number. He's estimating in the NFL that Friedman threw the ball for a little over 5,300 yards,
True.
which, you know, playing in the 1920s and the early 30s, that's, you know, the entire league over that span probably didn't throw for that much.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's a tremendous number for that period of time.
And that would make him, you know, unofficially the NFL's leading passer until Sammy Baugh passed that number in 1947. And it took him 10 years to get there. Sammy Baugh started playing in 1937. And the Redskins threw the ball a lot for that era. So it took him 10 years, you know, to get over 5,300 yards. And
Jeez.
he had his 66 touchdown passes were an NFL record until Sammy Baugh broke it in 1943. And that was an official record. The touchdown passes stand as fact.
He doesn't get as much credit as he should for being one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, because he probably is the model for the modern quarterback, you know?
Right. He doesn't have the stats that you can't look up, and he doesn't have the highlights.
Yeah, that's
You know, there's
very
no
true.
there's no videotape, there is no ESPN, there was no NFL game of the week when he played. You know, if you were lucky, you got like a couple of seconds on a newsreel in the movie theater. So he didn't have the hype machine behind him. He had to do it on his own. Just
Right.
the hopefully he had the right newspaper guy writing about his game, calling him a wizard rather than, you know, accusing him of playing gimmick football, not straight football.
Just a couple comments on some of the things that you said, just to try to put this in perspective here. Okay, you've said early on here, just in the segment, that the average attendance with Friedman went from 16,000 to just over 20,000. I mean, just sit there and think about that, how the Red Grange game of 1925 was 70,000.
That's right.
I mean, that's a lot more people than what
That's
their
right.
average attendance
That's
was.
right. And
So.
that game was actually the NFL, the pro football record for attendance until the Rams and the 49ers in 1950 at the what do you call it in Los Angeles?
The Coliseum.
Yes, the Los Angeles Coliseum. Thank you. It's
Yeah.
late in the day, man. You know, it's like we had a
Hey,
solar eclipse and everything. My brain is fried.
I know it messes with you. And just that, because now we sit there and say, oh, 70,000 people. It's an average
But
game.
that was rare then, you know, for pro
But
football.
that's
I
right.
mean, colleges
That's
would do that. You know, Michigan and Notre Dame and the big colleges would get big crowds, but not the pros, not at all.
especially with
A lot of teams had to give tickets away.
a team in their first year and nobody's really following them. They don't even know what they're about, and get 70,000. I don't think we appreciate that number as much. And you just made
No.
me appreciate it a whole lot more by you saying that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, I mean, just sit there and think about the Giants fans. When Friedman parts ways with the Giants and goes across town to play for Brooklyn, and when they're playing those games, that's got to be like a real kick in the gut when you have to see that, and your guy that you've been cheering on for the last couple seasons, now he's on
Right.
a different team,
Right. And then he goes and plays for the other guys.
especially one in town. That really has to bite you a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, one interesting thing which I've been learning reading, you know, researching my article for 1926, the NFL kind of, you know, you had the Giants in Manhattan and you had the AFL Yankees in the Bronx, and that was a territorial thing where Joe Carr had to step in and fix that situation. They kind of didn't mind Brooklyn. Like they, even though Brooklyn's part of New York City, they sort of viewed Brooklyn and Queens as like a different market than, you know, Manhattan and the Bronx. And, you know, if you think about travel then, I mean, the 1920s, not a lot of people had cars, you know, they had the subway, and it wasn't, you know, traveling from Brooklyn to Manhattan for a game or vice versa, you know, it just wasn't that easy and it wasn't that big of a deal. So they kind of, okay, they're over there in Brooklyn. That's, you know, they might as well be playing over in Jersey, you know?
That's right.
Right, because you had the Newark Bears too, and you had two teams in Brooklyn and two teams in New York. I mean, that year was just a mess. It was just a big mess. The Brooklyn teams ended up merging, and it was not good. One league went bankrupt, and the second one almost did.
Yeah.
But that'll be another interview.
Yeah, that's a whole different
Yeah.
story
But you
there.
know, the point is like Manhattan and Brooklyn, it really wasn't considered like Brooklyn wasn't considered a threat to the Giants. But the New York Yankees playing across the Harlem River, you know, from the Polo Grounds, that was a big problem because the Yankees were taking the Giants fans.
Now, I got sort of a hypothetical and like to hear your opinion on. Okay, since we're talking about this era, that first AFL, let's say that the Philadelphia Quakers aren't the more dominant team. Let's say Grange's Yankee team is more dominant. Do you think the AFL has a different fortune, and maybe even the Giants have a different fortune in?
It could have been, you know, that was the plan. The Tim Merritt hated CeCe Pyle, hated him, loathed him. Like it was a personal, visceral hatred. And he challenged him. It was in November, and I'm finding this in all the news. He challenged him to a game. Everyone assumed that the Yankees with Grange were going to win the AFL. And he said, we're going to take on the AFL champs and we're going to beat them. And the first time the Yankees played the Quakers, they beat them pretty bad. But then they played them a second time, and the Quakers beat the Yankees, and it was a huge upset. And the Yankees went into a little bit of a tailspin. They lost a couple of games after that. Philadelphia ended up winning the AFL title, which nobody really expected. And the Giants, I think Tim Mara was actually a little disappointed, and he still kind of pushed for the game with the Yankees. But CeCe Pyle backed out. He said, no, we're done. And then he wanted to take Red Grange barnstorming like Halas did the year before. So the Giants had to settle for the Quakers. And then, you know, they whipped them. And the Giants were like a fourth or fifth place team that year. And so that just destroyed any credibility the AFL had left.
Yeah, I
So
think
they did a dispersal with the players, and the Yankees were admitted into the league. But with a lot of restrictions on, you know, what days they could play and where they ended up playing a lot of road games.
I think that played out like perfectly into Mara's hands to sort of, stick it to CeCe Pyle a little bit,
Yeah.
even though he
Oh,
didn't get to play the Yankees directly, because there was a lot of people calling for Frankfurt won the which is a suburb of Philadelphia,
right.
won the
They won.
NFL title that year. The
Yep.
Philadelphia Quakers win the AFL. That's what everybody
Yep.
wanted to
That's
see.
right.
Hey, we want
Yeah.
this Philadelphia,
Yeah,
title
early in the
match.
year, that was a thing. That was in some of the Philadelphia newspapers.
So I think that when the Frankfurt team didn't want to play, I guess, and Mara's like holding up his hand.
I
Hey,
think Joe
I'll
Carr
play him.
prohibited it. He didn't want it to happen.
Right.
I think Joe Carr stopped it because there was the mess the year before when Pottsville played the Notre Dame All-Stars, and they ended up having to be suspended and they had to forfeit the title and the Cardinals, and he didn't want that to happen. But I think with the personal thing with Mara and Pyle, he kind of acquiesced and let that happen. And it ended up being a good thing for the NFL because, you know, like you were saying that year, the Yankees, you know, when they're for the NFL's fortunes, they were a real threat. You know, they were actually outdrawing the Giants. They had a number of home dates that coincided with the Giants, and the Yankees were drawing more fans than the Giants. And the Giants were really in dire straits. Like they lost, one of the articles I read estimated that Tim Mara lost about 50 grand that year. $50,000 in 1926 was a ton of money.
Yeah, especially since he only paid $500 for the franchise a year earlier.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they were in the red that year until the Red Grange game against the Bears when they had 70,000. That put them in the black so they can, you know, go forward and have a play again in 1926. You know, Red Grange saved them in 25, and then he almost bankrupt them in 1926 with the Yankees.
Right. Now, I guess the other hypothetical that which this really could have really turned bad for the NFL and for Tim Mara and the Giants is if Philadelphia Quakers would have beat the Giants in that game, that probably could have
Yeah.
been bad too, because the AFL was in dire straits at that point. I think that was sort of a desperation game for them.
Yeah.
They were clinging on. Oh, okay, some NFL team wants to play us. Okay, we'll play you. We need the cash. And,
Yeah. A bunch of their teams folded. I think at the end of the year, there were only four teams left: the Yankees, the Quakers, Wilson's Wildcats, and I think it was the Chicago Bulls. Those were the only, you know, Newark folded. The Brooklyn Horsemen merged with the Brooklyn Lions. There was a team in Boston that folded. I mean, the league was just in shambles. And CeCe Pyle bankrolled a lot of those teams. I think the only team that was actually sort of self-sufficient, self-sustaining was the Quakers. I think CeCe Pyle was like funneling money to most of the rest of the league. He basically built the league around one player, Red Grange. He
Right,
figured
yeah.
Red Grange, Red Grange plays around the country. Everybody goes to see him, like they did with the barnstorming with the Bears the year before. And I think that was, Pyle's game plan. I'm just going to run Red Grange around the circuit, and everybody's going to come see him, and we're going to be the bigger show. And for a little while, it looked like they kind of had a glimmer, but it fell apart on them in a hurry.
Yeah, I think that whole thing, like you alluded to earlier, that whole Tim Mara, CeCe Pyle thing, because really it started, CeCe Pyle was trying to stick it to Mara when he rented out, when Hollis went and paid Grange. CeCe
Yeah.
Pyle goes, okay, screw you, NFL. Or he didn't really say screw you, NFL. He said, okay, screw you, George
It
Halas. We're going to
didn't.
start a franchise. I got a contract in Yankee Stadium for
Yeah.
5 years,
He leased Yankee Stadium before he had a spot in the league.
And he tries to go to Joe Carr and say, okay, we're going to put our team in here. And Mara sort of, boycotts it and blackballs him. And then he goes, screw you, NFL.
Yeah. But that the territorial rights was established the year before when Pottsville played the Notre Dame All-Stars in Philadelphia. And there was a big dispute, and Joe Carr said, you're in violation. This is the Yellow Jackets territory. You can't stage games here. So they had to forfeit the title. So that precedent was set in 1926 when CeCe Pyle wanted to play at Yankee Stadium, which was right is walking distance from the Polo Grounds. If you look at a picture, there's this little bridge over the Harlem River between the Polo Grounds and Yankee Stadium. You could walk from one to the other, and he wanted to stage his games like 500 yards from where the Giants were playing. And he said, no, you can't do that. So he said, screw you, I'm going to start my own league. Like Eric Cartman, screw you guys, I'm going home.
Right.
And I'm going to take Red Grange, and I'm going to start my own league, and I'm going to show you.
Now that probably segues why maybe like you said, the Philadelphia Quakers were another successful team from that AFL when they were folding. They were the champions, but
Yeah.
that's because of Frankfurt being right there, Pottsville
Yeah.
being 60 miles away, that the
Yeah. Well,
territorial rights thing came in again, because Joe Carr at that point was defending Frankfurt's territorial rights. That's why Pottsville lost their
right. And
championship.
football was hugely, football is hugely popular in Pennsylvania. That's where the coal mine leagues were, and that's where Hingy Haines came from. I mean, people love football in Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia actually maybe could have supported two teams. Maybe. Like Chicago had two teams. Didn't work out that well in New York for a while. Early, in the 1920s, it was tenuous because, New York has so much going on. It had three baseball teams. And, college football was big in New York then. People like the Polo Grounds would sell out for Fordham and NYU games. They'd have 55,000 people for Fordham and Columbia or NYU. And then the next day, the Giants would play for in front of 15,000. And some of those tickets were probably given away.
Probably,
And,
hey, people had to go to church, you couldn't go to a football game.
That's right.
Wow, very great stuff. I love these, the other bits of history, how the NFL and pro football history intertwines around these teams and these players that we spoke about today. So great stuff, Larry.
Yeah, thank you. It's so interesting, and I love going into the newspaper archives, and it's full of surprises. If you don't mind nosing around and digging a little bit, I mean, you just find stuff all the time. I've been doing it for a long time, and I'm still learning. It's a journey of learning. I'm just curious, and I'm just thankful that you give me an outlet to share all this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So why don't you, before we let you go, let's share the links where people can see your work on both places that you do a lot of writing for.
Yeah, well, I do my writing for Big Blue Interactive. And of course, I do the uniform research. I help out Bill Schaefer at the GUD a lot. So I don't write much on there. But when you look at the old uniforms, that Bill does all that fantastic artwork for, a lot of times he'll send me into the newspaper archives to find photos. So those are, it's a passion project for me. I love all things about old time football.
And we love that you love that and share it with us. So very, very much appreciate, my friend, and love to talk to you again about some more Giants things as we go through for this year of talking Giants history.
Yeah, 100 years. You can only have one 100th anniversary, so let's do it up.
That's for sure. But thank you very much, Larry, for joining us, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
All right, thank you.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.